You guys don't mess around here. We get right into it. Which I knew, but still. Hi, everybody. My name is Sean, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is November 25th, 2007. I have a home group. It's the Common Solution Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet at 7:30 on Thursday nights at Hinton Avenue United Methodist Church in Charlottesville, Virginia. If you're ever down that way, please come join us. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor. And that's really actually a good thing, because when I have an issue that's outside of my sponsor's experience, with my permission, he goes to his sponsor. And sometimes it goes beyond that. And I really get to share in a lot of great experience, strength, and hope through the sponsorship line that I'm a part of. I also am lucky enough to get to sponsor a handful of guys, both of whom made the trip up here today. And that was, I knew they were going to do it, but that was nice. I did make an optional. I didn't say you had to. I'm going to try and tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Funny thing happened this morning at church. Our pastor brought up a couple of the 12 steps during church, and it was just kind of funny. And a buddy of mine was sitting next to me who knows my story, and he knew that I was speaking later this evening. And he said, "So how long do you have to speak for?" I'm like, 45, 50 minutes. He said, "Do you find that hard?" And I said, "No, you know, because I get to talk about myself for an hour, and really that's not that hard." So I grew up in what is pretty well a normal, everyday, average American dysfunctional alcoholic family. My dad was an alcoholic. My mother was a great enabler and a codependent. I'm the oldest of five, so we were always a little strange from the rest of time. I mean, you know, seven people in a family, it was starting to be a big family even as I was coming up. People just didn't have big families. It was the time of minivans, and we didn't get a minivan. No, we had to get a big eight-passenger van, so people called it the Shank Tank. It was just, and we had this eight-passenger minivan. We just went through a whole slew of them, and so it was always a little different. And felt a little set apart from people, I was, as the oldest, I didn't have to worry about going through school and having the teachers know my older siblings. But my mom was real involved because there were five of us, and so they knew who our family was. And so there were some expectations that I needed to be more or less a reasonable person. And I did that. I was kind of too scared not to. I did not... My dad got up every morning at the crack of dawn, drove to D.C., worked all day, drove home from D.C., started drinking, drank till he passed out, went to bed, got up and did it all over again. And on Saturdays and Sundays, he drank all day. And I didn't want to be him. I don't remember him being around a lot in our family. And so growing up, I did not want to be that guy. So I really didn't want to have anything to do with alcohol. I don't really remember having my first drink because, my mom would serve it to us at Thanksgiving dinner as we got a little older. And I don't really remember that being a big deal. It's just, okay, there's a glass of wine on the table. You're finally old enough, you 13, 14, whatever it was, there's a glass of wine, you got one. And I don't remember trying to sneak a second one. I don't remember any of that growing up. I do remember being different. I do remember being set apart. It was easier for me to converse with the adults than it was with the kids that were my own age. I always felt like the kids that were my own age were speaking some sort of special code that I didn't understand. And the adults, I guess I sort of figured out what they wanted, and so I just did what they wanted. It was great because everybody's parents thought I was the safest guy in the world to be with. It was also great because I could walk into any convenience store in town and buy beer, because everybody just assumed that if Sean was buying beer, that everything was going to be okay. Because I wouldn't drink. I didn't want to be my dad, so I wasn't going to start drinking. But people really only hung out with me because of what they could get out of me, So I wanted out of that. I wanted out of the town I grew up in. I wanted as far away from my family as I possibly could get because I didn't want to carry around the weight of this large family into whatever I did next. So really looking back on it now, I did what would be my first of many geographic relocations. I picked a school. I didn't pick of the two schools I got in, I did not pick the one that was 12 hours away. 7 hours seemed perfectly reasonable. Nobody could come get me. Nobody could come visit me unannounced. I just didn't want my family around. So I went off to school 7 hours away. That was, and I went to this school that decided that the way it was going to deal with its drinking problem, because there was a drinking problem on campus, the way it was going to deal with the alcohol problem on campus was, instead of cracking down on all the underage drinkers, they were just going to set a limit of how much alcohol you were allowed to have in your room, regardless of how old you were. And if you were under that limit, everything was A-okay. My dad took me up to college, being the good alcoholic that he was, decided that I needed to have the limit in my room. So that meant I had two cases of beer and a fifth of liquor when my dad left me at college. That was considered the right amount for personal consumption, yeah. No more than that at any one time. College was a weird, strange place. I grew up in Winchester, Virginia, right at the top of the state. Still not really a great big cosmopolitan place. And I went off to Rochester, New York, and a lot of things were introduced into my world that I just didn't know about. I knew about some things. Don't get me wrong. I was not a saint growing up. I mean, I did what I needed to do growing up, but I was still good enough that everybody thought I was good. But there were so many things that I didn't know about in the world when I got up to Rochester. And I was really just kind of, wide-eyed and scared and shell-shocked and not sure what to do. And, my first experience, my first day at college, I went to this party and was having a miserable time. It was the last party I ever remember having a miserable time at. I had two beers, and I'm like, I'm going home. I got to get up at the crack of dawn. And I got back to my dorm room, and apparently my roommate had a live-in girlfriend. And I hadn't met him yet. So my introduction to the two of them was a little interesting. And I remember spending a lot of that first quarter sleeping out in the lounge, because that was the only place where it was quiet. I don't remember how many days into college that I was there. I hurt my knee pretty early on and was completely set apart from... I had an Army ROTC scholarship. That was why I chose where I went to choose. And I thought, I'm going to be a part of the Army. This is where I'm finally going to be a part of. And because I was searching for a group other than my family to be a part of. I blew up my knee pretty early on, so then was all of a sudden not a part of this thing that I was intending to be a part of. And somebody said, why don't you just hang out and drink with us? I had beer in my room. I had liquor in my room. So it turns out I'm actually pretty good at drinking. Didn't know this at the time. I didn't know this when I got started, but apparently I have a pretty high tolerance, and apparently I'm a lot of fun when I'm drinking. And I spent a lot of the next year just letting alcohol do for me what I couldn't do for myself. If I was not fitting in with people, I could start drinking, and all of a sudden everybody liked me, or at least I thought everybody liked me. Maybe I was fitting in with people before, and maybe I felt like I fit in better once I started drinking. No real consequences. I remember feeling a lot miserable, a lot. And, the consequences at the end of that first year was I had to go home. I didn't get to come back because I didn't keep my grades up, and I'd blown out my knee, and all sorts of other things. And but that a pattern was firmly established in my life, and the pattern really was whenever I wasn't comfortable, I'd start drinking. If I wasn't comfortable in a situation, I'd start drinking. Now, I still didn't really want to become my dad, so that did mean I went to extreme lengths to not hide my drinking, but try to moderate my drinking. Or, okay, I'm not feeling comfortable, but I can make it one more day with this awful feeling, but then I'm going to have to drink again. Things being as they were, after spending a year or so at home, I put myself in a situation where, because of my drinking, I ended up in locked into a treatment facility for a weekend because Well, because somebody thought that what I had said sounded a lot like I wanted to kill myself. And that was probably the first time I ever got any introduction to these steps. It was not, there were no AA meetings, but we had to sit in on a couple group meetings in this psych ward at the hospital, and the steps were on the wall, and I remember reading them and thinking, all right, well, I'm out at step one, because I didn't, at that point, was not willing to admit that I was powerless or that my life was unmanageable. I'm locked in a psych facility because I had too much to drink. I'm not powerless over alcohol. My life's not unmanageable. Happened to be the same weekend that O.J. Simpson was running around in his white Bronco. I just remember that because I remember all of us sitting in the lounge watching O.J. Simpson on TV, because our lives were so miserable at that moment that watching O.J. Simpson in his white Bronco on the, you know, on the 105 was the most fascinating thing in the world. Missed my sister's graduation, lost my job. Because apparently I'm not stable, since I think I'm going to kill myself. It's highly overstated. So I make my second geographic and move to Charlottesville. And honestly, the way I ended up in Charlottesville is I had a buddy who was going to Charlottesville to find a room because he was going to go to the university. And so he was looking for an apartment. He said, why don't you don't have a job, why don't you come down with me for the weekend and just hang out? The party was so good in Charlottesville that I just stayed. I just didn't want to go. I mean, yeah, by the end of the weekend, we'd signed a lease on a two-bedroom apartment, and I didn't want to go home. I'm like, fine, there's nothing left at home. I'll just move. You know, the party's good here. It's, you know, I'm a young guy. I'll just start over. I'll recreate myself. Grand plans here. And that was the next year was miserable. I waited tables. I can remember distinctly spending so much money on alcohol, going out and partying and having a good time, that at the end of the month, you know, I'd pick up every double shift that was available so I could make enough money to pay my rent. And I really would mark the last 3 days of the month and the first 2 days of the next month off in red, because I would white knuckle it for 5 days to make enough money to pay my rent and then to make a little bit of money so I could start drinking again. And you know, and it's funny, I'm going to share something that I don't think I've ever said out loud in connection here. Towards the end of that year, I started having panic attacks, and, you know, we went through this whole thing of trying to figure that out, and that really was just alcoholic self-obsession run amok. And, you know, I was just spiritually sick, and I really hadn't realized, I mean, I did realize that I was spiritually sick during that time period, but I was so concerned about what people thought about me that I couldn't stop thinking about it. I'd walk into a room, and I just assumed that everybody in the room was thinking about me. And now I'm going to sound crazy. That's about the time that the voices in the back of my head started, the little voices that said, you're not good enough, you know, these people don't like the way you wear your hair, these people don't like your clothes, these people think you're fat, these people think you're skinny, these people think you're a weakling, these people think you're gay, these people think... And I don't know what any of this stuff was. I don't know any of this stuff was true, because, I mean, I actually know now that probably nobody was thinking about me because they're all too busy thinking about themselves. But at the time, that's when the voices in the, you know, you don't have enough money, you're not smart enough, you don't, you know, you don't have the degree, you're not, you know, you're not good enough, you're not good looking. And I think that's about the time that I started lying. And I lied pretty much then for the next 14 years, 15 years until I stopped drinking. You know, I would go out into bars at night, and in order to impress people, I would tell stories. They're not really lies, because as long as you're not, you know, as long as you're just telling a story, it's not really a lie, and who cares what you tell to another person who's been drinking, right? You know, so, I mean, joking earlier, you know, your name's Sean, right? You know, well, you call me anything you want, because at the time, I really would have answered to anything. I'd tell people my name was Joe. I'd tell people my name was Matt. I'd tell people my name was Marcus. I'd tell people my name was Seth. I went to Yale. I went to Harvard. I had a degree from UCLA. I made up these grand stories so that when I'm hanging out at these college bars with these young college-age women, that I would be impressive. Because I'm a little older than them, and so, you know, I wanted to be the impressive older guy with money and a cool story. I don't think it ever got me anywhere. Just, you know, but I probably couldn't actually keep the story straight long enough for it to get me anywhere. But I threw around a lot of money and drank a lot of booze, and you know, I had to drink to keep the voices quiet in my head. I threw around a lot of money so that people would hang out with me, because I was putting myself in a position where I was completely and totally alone. So, you know, I was the director who would do nice things for people so that they would do what I wanted them to do, and what I wanted them to do was to stand next to me, to not go very far away from me. I kind of had a sense that my world was unraveling, but I didn't really know that everything was falling apart. Somewhere in there, I met the woman that would marry me. And I will say this at least three different times tonight. The woman, my wife is a saint. She married me almost 15 years ago now, and she's managed to stay with me through everything. And I don't know why she married me, and I don't know why she stayed with me, other than it must really be love. And she really has the patience of a saint. I can remember distinctly getting really nervous and uptight about the impending nuptials and having a few too many drinks and going to her apartment and telling that she had to leave, that she should not marry me, that she should call this off, and because that all I was going to do was ruin her life. And that I think she patted me on the head and said, there, everything's going to be okay, and let me sleep it off on her couch. Marrying her did bring a small sense of normalcy to my life. She was really good at looking the other way, too. But she had certain expectations, and I knew what to do when people had expectations. I'd grown up in high school knowing what to do when people had expectations. She had a certain set of expectations. I had to go to work. I could sort of manage that. I had to go to church with her on Sunday mornings. I could pretty well manage that. So I did a lot of uncomfortable kind of dancing around and doing the things that she wanted me to do. But the good news is I fell into this job that where I worked really hard for the first year and a half that I was in this job. And apparently it was hard enough because when the guy who was my boss left, they made me the boss. And this all of a sudden made my world perfect because as the boss, I didn't have anybody else to look over me. So I, as long as I got my job done, I could make my schedule whatever I wanted it to be. And this was fantastic because if I didn't want to come in before 10, I just wouldn't come in before 10 and tell everybody that I had meetings in the morning, which meant that I could drink pretty much as late as I wanted in the evening. And as long as I was cleaned up and looked good at 10 a.m., nobody really cared. If I wanted to go have a long lunch because I needed to get a couple of drinks in, I could go for a long lunch and nobody really paid any attention. And I would just work late, and I kept a bottle in my desk drawer. So if I worked late, I'd just, you know, pour bourbon while I was sitting at the office doing work. Also in that time, I decided that, I needed an athletic outlet that would help me not drink as much. You know, I'm going to fix myself. And so, I decided I'd start playing rugby. If you ever want to hide your alcoholism, play rugby. A whole piece of the sport revolves around drinking. Right after the game, you shake the other team's hand, and then you have what they call a drink up. It's the after party. You go right to the drink up, and everybody drinks to excess, or at least I thought everybody drank to excess. And so I put in a pattern where, you know, Tuesdays and Thursdays were practice nights, and everybody would go out after practice. And I know now that I was the one leading the charge to drink as late as possible. On Wednesday, I would kind of white-knuckle it through the day and sober up. You know, drink on Tuesday, drink on Thursday. Friday, I really never felt the need to drink because getting ready for the big game on Saturday. Saturday, we'd play the game, and then I would start drinking the second the game was over, and I would drink pretty much until I had to meet my wife to go to church on Sunday morning. Some nights not, but it was great. And then we'd do the church thing with my wife, and then everybody was hanging out on Sunday, having a cookout or whatever. And so then you just stand around and drink on Sunday and then have to white-knuckle it through on Monday. And I spent years living like that. You know, I'm going to drink as hard as I want when it's appropriate for me to drink as hard as I want. and I'm going to, you know, and I'll white knuckle it in between. And in the off season, I just, you know, I tell my wife, well, I'm going to stop for one on the way home. And my one was a pint of Guinness and a shot of whiskey. That's what I meant when I said one, and I never meant I'm going to have, when I said I'm going to have one, I meant I'm going to have two of my two drinks at a minimum. And I can remember her calling me often and saying, where are you? I'm around the corner. I'll be home for dinner I'll be home for dinner in a couple of minutes. It's 10 o'clock. Where are you? I'm like, I don't know what happened. Time got away from me. A couple other people walked in. I've just been sitting here talking to him. 3 hours later, where are you? I'll be home in a couple minutes. We just had this conversation. It's 1 a.m. Where are you? I had no idea. I'd lose time all the time. I wouldn't black out. I just would lose complete track of time. My dad died. He drank himself to death. And I went another year of living this way. I broke my leg in there, too. It was great. You know, broke my leg, hopped up on morphine, broke my leg playing rugby, hopped up on morphine, went to the rugby party because it's what you do, drank, hopped up on morphine and fentanyl. All you doctors and nurses, that's not a good idea. my dad died in there. I just couldn't stop. And I knew, I still didn't think I was like my dad. Somewhere during the time I was married to my wife, or after I was first married to my wife, I realized that I was powerless over alcohol. I would say in the bar that I was an alcoholic. But I had this test. As long as I could stop drinking, because I had this bartender buddy who had once told me he was an alcoholic, but his test for how he knew he could still control it was that he would stop drinking between St. Patrick's Day and Derby Day every year. It's like 6 weeks. And I thought, that's it. You know, my life's not unmanageable as long as I can make that. And the first year, I think I quit between St. Patrick's Day and Derby Day. Second year, I thought, well, that's a little too long. I stopped between St. Patrick's Day and Easter. I think the third year, Easter was on like the 23rd of March or something. St. Patrick's Day is the 17th of March. I'm like, ah, it's a week. Ah, I'm not going to stop. And plowed right on through, and that was the last time I plowed right on through. Yeah, that was the last time I ever seriously tried to stop drinking. The last year of my drinking came after my dad died. I remember having one more sort of good night of drinking about a week and a half after he died. It was my birthday. I was in Dallas. I was alone. I was on business. And, you know, it's one of those nights where, you know, every once in a while you have one of those nights where you party and everything's great and everything goes well and you're witty and fun and you meet witty and fun. I met Sean Salisbury that night. He, you know, NFL analyst for ESPN. It was just this, like, weird night. I think that was the last really good night of drinking I had. From there on out, it was all downhill. The alcohol didn't work. It didn't matter how much I drank. I couldn't make the voices stop. I'd broken my leg, so I wasn't playing rugby. So I was hanging out with these guys and still leading the charge. I had to find some other things to help me drink more because I wouldn't black out. I wouldn't pass out. I wouldn't lose time. I just couldn't keep physically ingest enough. And so I got involved in some other things, really just so that I could drink more alcohol. It was anything that would help me drink more alcohol. I had actually, right after I broke my leg, had tried pain pills No, that just didn't, it just made me not want to move. It didn't fix the noises in my head, and I couldn't really drink very much because I didn't want to move. So I liked uppers. They made you drink a lot longer. Upped your tolerance for a guy like me. It's, you know, that put my tolerance on steroids times three. It really was insane. I can look back on some of those nights and look back on some of the, and know what some of those credit card receipts looked like and know what I consumed on those nights. And it was insane. I was very quickly, losing my mind, and losing really any sense of reality. It all came crashing down one evening, about 2 a.m. I was almost home, literally 2 blocks from my house, and stopped at a convenience store and got Gatorade and, you know, whatever I got at the end of a night of drinking. because I think I had to be reasonable the next day, and I decided that I would, oh no, my wife's sister was staying. My wife's sister had come over to the house with her boyfriend. They were going to visit with us, and I had left because I didn't want to be there. You know, my wife didn't ask a lot of me, and I just didn't want to be there. I didn't want to have to deal with this person. And so I turned around and went. They were not staying the night. They had just come for dinner, and I had left as soon as dinner was over. So I turned around and went to this after-hours bar and got patted down and found with an illegal substance and, you know, thought my world was over, but he didn't arrest me for a whole host of reasons. And so I walked out of there and got in my car and drove home. You know, I'm basically going to be arrested any minute now. He's taken this illegal substance and get it tested, and I'm going to be arrested when he finds out what it is. And I got in my car after a long night of drinking and drove home. Got to my house and made the only kind of plea I know how to make to my wife, frothy emotional one, that I am never going to drink again. I absolutely positively am never going to drink again. Here's what happened, and I am never going to drink again. That was Friday night. Saturday, I think we worked in the yard, and I think I spent all day concerned about when the cops were going to pull up and arrest me. We had two small children at this point, and I'm like, I'm going to get arrested in front of my kids while I'm moving mulch. The whole neighborhood's going to know that SWAT cars, you know, again, I think I'm more important than I am. That didn't happen. Sunday, one of our children were sick. My youngest was sick, not even really old enough to pay attention. So my wife took the oldest to church and asked that I do. Both my boys were born in December, and this was late November. And my wife asked me to go ahead and do the birthday shopping and the Christmas shopping because we've got the infant who really doesn't know what you're doing. So I go to Toys R Us, and I'm really starting to feel uncomfortable because I haven't had a drink, and I think the cops are coming to get me, and I haven't had a drink, and it's Thanksgiving weekend, and I'm in a toy store, and there's way too many people in there for me. And I get out to the car with my son and the presents, and I'm thinking, I think I can go home and make a gin and tonic and drink three or four of those before my wife gets home, and she won't ever know. Because we had a full bar in the house. Because I had to have a full bar in the house, and every bottle of liquor possible, I had a full bar in my house. And I'm thinking, the first thought was, I think I can drink a couple, and my wife won't ever know. 2 days earlier, I'd made this frothy emotional plea, I'm never going to drink again. I swear to you, I promise you, I'll never drink again. I've got my 1-year-old son in the car, not quite 1-year-old son in the car, and I'm going to go home and see how drunk I can get before my wife gets home and see if I can hide it from her. And then the next thought, just a brief moment of desperation, a window of willingness and openness was, you know, your brother got sober. Call him. So I called my brother. It's 10:30 on a Sunday morning. Most reasonable people are still in bed. If you work the kind of hours my brother does. And he picked up the phone a little groggy, and I said, hey, how do I find a meeting? No preamble, no, how you doing? No, what's going on? Hey, I got a question for you. Yeah? How do I find a meeting? And he's like, I just woke up. And he did some things for a couple of minutes and said, hey, hang on. This is a little trickier than I thought it was. Give me 5 minutes. I'll call you right back. 5 minutes later, he called me back and he said, right before he hung up, he says, are you getting ready to drink? No. Can you not drink until I call you back? Yes. All right. Call you right back. 5 minutes later, and it really couldn't have been more than five, it might have only been three, he calls me back and says, do you know where Wesley Memorial Foundation is on Emmett Street in Charlottesville? Yes. There's a meeting there at 8 o'clock. Okay. I'm going to be there in 5 hours. He was in North Carolina at the time. And this guy Larry is meeting us at that meeting. Can you not drink until I get there? What do you mean you're coming up here? As Lynn so kindly pointed out, he said, that's what we do. And my brother got in the car, and he drove up here, and he took me to that meeting. It was in the basement of the Wesley Foundation. It was an 11th tradition meeting. I joke about the fact that I have no idea what the 11th tradition is. I remember wanting to punch the happiest guy in the room at that meeting. I don't even remember why, beyond he shook everybody's hand and said hello to everybody and then made some smart-ass comment to my brother when he sat down, and I just wanted to punch this guy. But I also remember my brother putting the big book in my hands, and I knew I'd seen it around because I know my brother had given one to my dad. My dad had asked for one a couple of times, and so I'd seen them, but I'd never looked at it. And my brother opened it to the story of the Jaywalker, and he said, "Read this." And I read it, and I thought, oh, my God, that's me. Now, I don't remember what else was said in that meeting, and I don't remember identifying with anybody else in the room, and it was a closed meeting, so I had to introduce myself as something, but for the first time in my life, I didn't want to introduce myself as an alcoholic. I had said at the bar that I was an alcoholic before, but sitting in that closed meeting, I was not at all going to say, "Hi, my name is Sean, and I'm an alcoholic." And so I believe what I introduced, my brother gave me a list of like four things I could say to be okay in a closed meeting. And he actually said, "You can say whatever you want. They're not going to kick you out." But, one of them I think was, "I have a desire to stop drinking." And that's how I introduced myself that first night, because I was terrified of introducing myself as an alcoholic. Now that I'm finally sitting in a room, I was terrified of introducing myself as an alcoholic. My brother would stay 3 or 4 days. He would get me to a bunch of meetings. But it's funny, on Monday we went to two meetings. We went to a lunchtime meeting, and then we went to an evening meeting. And at that evening meeting, a bunch of the guys from my home group were at that meeting. And, I picked up my white chip at that meeting because I've been too scared. They didn't do it at the Sunday night meeting. I'd been too scared at the noon meeting to pick up a white chip. Didn't really understand it. But I picked up a white chip at that meeting and introduced myself as a newcomer. And these six or seven different guys from what's now my home group came up to me and, I swear, cornered me. That's not really how it went, but I felt like they were cornering me. And, an alcoholic armed with facts about themselves can carry a message that carries weight and depth that nobody else can get through to me on. And I heard some things from these guys, and they were showing me what meetings to get to on the meeting list, and they may have had a little bit of agenda. It doesn't even matter. But everybody talked about, in fact, one of the guys was the guy I'd wanted to punch the night before. Everybody said, you got to get to this Thursday night meeting. My brother left midweek. I mean, I don't think he left. I think he left before my brother's never been to my home group. So I think he left before he even ever got to that first meeting, because he knew that I'd gotten hooked in enough that he'd done all he could do. He told me, he was very clear with me, he was not going to be my sponsor. He was very clear with me that I didn't need to feel like I owed him anything for coming up there. That if I didn't get sober, that was between me and whatever, but that he was willing to come up, and that I had helped him more than he had helped me, he was sure, and that I didn't ever need to worry about repaying any debt. And he left, and I started going to meetings. I did not. I'd love to say that, I've been told 90 meetings, 90 days. I'd love to say I did that. I didn't do that. I was stubborn. I went to enough meetings that I could see enough people that I guess I at that point sort of cared what people thought about me. I don't know why, really, because I wasn't sure I wanted to be here. I can remember distinctly, the guy who met me at the first meeting offered to be my temporary sponsor. That was probably a good thing for a guy like me, because I wasn't ever going to ask for help. So he threw me a softball, and that was really nice. Because he did. He invited me to his house, and we sat down and we started reading the book. I'm like, really? This is what we're going to do? We're going to read the book out loud? Because I think I know better, because I think I'm smarter. I'm running this small company, and I don't have a college degree, and I've really lifted myself up from nothing, and I think I'm smarter than everybody else. And we went at exactly the pace we needed to go. I was convinced at one point that I'd done my third step, because, my consequences did come apparent, but the cop did call me and let me turn myself in, and so I had to go down to the jail and get processed and blah, 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 and I'm sitting there waiting to get my mugshot taken. And I, you know, I prayed what was a foxhole prayer. I mean, I'd gone to church most of my life, so I kind of had some idea of prayer. I was a little mad at God because he'd never gotten me sober. And I'll get into that. But, I said, and I was clear at that point. It was about 2 weeks without a drink. I'd been to enough meetings and read enough things that I had this obsession and this craving thing. So I just prayed that that obsession and that craving would be lifted. And I really did feel this experience where a weight came off my shoulders. Now, all that gave me was enough strength to keep going to meetings. It really didn't do anything for me. Lots of people can have white light experiences. It was a very brief, minor white light experience. It helped clear my head enough for me to hear the instructions from my sponsor, which were get to meetings, make it here to show up to talk to me, don't drink every day, or don't drink at all, and don't tell a new lie. Because I was terrified. You know, the part in How It Works, it talks, talks about being honest with yourself, and I didn't think I was able to do that. So he kept it really simple. Just don't tell any lie today. Very quickly realized that I hadn't actually done a third step, and then my sponsor made me do this formal third step and blah, and then I did nothing. And I got sick in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, this isn't working for me. And I wanted to walk out the door. And as always happens, I went to a string of meetings that were all on doing your fourth step. Because as it turns out, really, you haven't done the third step until you decide to move on with the rest of the steps. That's how you turn your carry. So I said, all these people are talking about dancing around doing their fourth step, and I wasn't going to do it because I thought it had to be perfect. Because I had to write everything perfect, and I'm this perfectionist person, and I fancy myself a bit of a writer and, this creative writer. So, I got my words have to be right. And everybody basically said that's baloney, and that they got relief after they finished their fourth step and did their fifth step with their sponsor. So for the pretty much the only time in working with that sponsor, I called him up and said, hey, we need to schedule my fifth step. He said, have you done your fourth step? I said, nope, but we need to put my fifth step on the books so that I can do my fourth step. God bless him, that man said, okay. I sort of demanded and said, this is how I'm going to do this. And I did follow the rest of his instructions, and I was mostly teachable. But he was kind enough to say, he said, okay, when do you want to do it? I said, and I think this was a Saturday or Sunday night. I said, Monday? He said, I can't do Monday. Can you do Tuesday? And I remember, and I said, yes. And I remember sitting down and writing my fourth step, and I don't remember how many pages it was. It seemed like a lot at the time. But it came spilling out of me in like 4 hours. I just sat down and did it because I had a deadline and I was okay with having a deadline. And everything that I'd ever done spilled out of me. And then I went and I shared it with my sponsor, and he laughs at me because he's like, that's it? And I'm like, what? He's like, you know better or worse than the rest of us. You're just like everybody else in here. And I don't remember feeling any relief from that meeting. And he gave me some specific instructions on 6 and 7. And so, I followed those instructions and then decided I was smarter than everybody else again and decided I would tackle the amends on my own. Because taking the fifth step didn't help give me this sense of ease and comfort that I thought it would. But surely making amends would help. And actually, I think the way that I read that was... became willing to have everybody absolve you of your problems, of your harms. So the first person I went to was my wife, because remember I said earlier that she's a saint, and listed off a whole host of ways that I harmed her, and again, God bless her, she was just really easy to deal with, and she said, you know what, you just keep doing what you're doing, and you keep moving forward, and you keep not drinking. And that's going to be good enough for me to make this right. And I thought, yes. And that was so easy. So I thought I'd go to my boss. Because I had these two great big relationships in my life. I didn't have a lot of, some financial amends to my wife, mostly, to the family. I had to, stop spending more than I made and pay off some debt. And I didn't have a lot of other financial amends, but most of them were relationship amends. And so I went to my boss because it's the other person I dealt with every day, and he had been kind enough to let me keep my job because I had gone to him and told him about my legal troubles and, you know, really thought that he was going to let me go because a guy like me handles a bunch of money, might have a problem with a fairly significant drug that costs a lot of money, and I have access to lots of money. I thought he might freak out, and instead actually he helped get me some legal advice and some court advice, and he'd been really good to me. So I decided that I was going to do this amends, and I did not, let me make this clear, I never consulted my sponsor. I did not read the instructions out of the book. I charged into his office. Charged is strong. I went into his office and said, hey, so here are all the ways that I've harmed you. And because everything had gone so easily with my wife, I said, so do you have anything to add? And he didn't say anything. And I said, great, well, we're good then. And I walked out of his office. I think that was a Wednesday, might have been a Tuesday. He comes to me a couple days later and says, we really need to meet. I want you to come to my house on Friday so we can have a discussion about the business. And really what it was is he had had time to think about everything that I had said in my amends. And he unloaded on me, deservedly so. Everything I had said I had done, some other things that I needed to hear, anything he had done wrong in the business in the 8 or 9 years of our relationship at that point, everything that was wrong with the business was my fault, and he just unloaded on me. I deserved it. I really deserved to have all that laid bare. I walked out, called my sponsor, told him what happened. I was furious. He says, well, you know what? Now you have to go make an amends because you haven't done one yet. And now you have a new resentment too. So I did at that point take instructions because I felt a good deal of pain. I didn't do anything unless I felt a good deal of pain. And I didn't ever do anything unless I felt a good deal of pain. And I did finally go make a real honest-to-goodness amends to my boss. And it was from that point forward that we started to be able to have an adult relationship, a relationship that real people have. We could get mad at each other and I could go in and tell him where I was wrong and apologize for that and then work to make it right. He could get mad at me. And amazingly, when I was humble enough to admit my wrongs, when he lost his temper with me, he would come in and tell me that he had just messed up that conversation and would I please. And that didn't happen immediately, but that's where our relationship is today. Immediately, we were still a little wary of each other, but every time I made a mistake in a dealing with him, I went in and admitted my fault and, you know, took responsibility for my actions. His heart softened, and we can have a relationship now that is a fantastic working relationship. So I'm moving right along and feeling pretty well recovered and thinking that my life is in good shape, and so I stopped going to as many meetings. And I get this fancy job in my home group on the GSR because I'm important. And so I have to go to this other, you know, district meeting, and, you know, I count that as a meeting. You know, well, I'm doing all this district service work, so. But really what ended up happening is also during that time, for whatever reason, my sponsor and I had trouble getting together. I'd schedule things, his work would get in the way. We're friends at this point, but it was a really rough set of months. And I remember at one point I woke up going to one meeting a week, not really being sponsored by anybody. Well, okay, sponsoring myself, having another sponsor in name only, and looking around. It's about 2.5 years sober. I don't have any sponsees. Wonder why. I'm not getting asked to speak. I feel on the outside of my group. We talk about in our home group about, you know, being a school of fish, and if you stay in the middle and go the same direction as everybody else, you'll be okay, and if you're on the outside, you'll get picked off. And And it also occurs to me that my marriage is starting to unravel. This woman who was a saint is suddenly not doing things good enough for me. You know, I'm making all this effort, and I'm doing all these wonderful things for her, and I'm not getting what I deserve. Because I deserve things in return, because I'm putting the kids on the bus, and I'm making dinners, and I'm making sacrifices for the family, and I'm not working as much as I need to or as I want to, and doing all this AA stuff. All this AA stuff, not really much at all. And I realized that after, and I'd say, I went to several meetings in 1 week, and they were all about, I went to several meetings in 1 month, like three, and they were all in the same thing. And it was about losing your mind in sobriety. Funny how that works. And I realized in one of those meetings that I was sponsoring myself. And so picked a guy in my home group that I knew well and that I had a good rapport with, and asked him if he'd sponsor me. And he said, well, I'm going to require certain things. And the first one is that you get to, three or four meetings a week, and I really mean four. And I said, okay, I'm going to require that you call me. I said, okay. I'm going to require you that you wear a college shirt to meetings. Well, that wasn't a problem. I already do that. There really wasn't anything wrong with that. And I was desperate to do with whatever he wanted. And he said, well, and I want you to get in the car with us on Tuesday nights and drive an hour to this meeting out of town. I said, no. He said, okay, that's not a requirement. It's a suggestion. And so I'll let you slide on that for now, but you need to be getting to meetings. And a funny thing happened. I started going to 3.5 meetings a week. Making four is sometimes really difficult for me, but I get to as many as I can. I have three that I try to get to every week and try and pick up a fourth or a fifth whenever I can. And my sponsor and I are okay with what I'm doing. But going to more meetings, all of a sudden the problems at home became smaller. Going to more meetings, all of a sudden it became easier to do the service work that I was doing. I had been asked if I would serve as the district treasurer, because they asked everybody in the room if they would serve as the district treasurer. I count money for a living, so it was not an unreasonable AA request, so I said yes. I don't know whether at the time I felt like it was the biggest mistake of my life, and now, that's been a great service position for me. I don't know what I'm going to do when my term to serve is up at the end of the year. I don't know what I'll do next. But when I first started doing that, I was bullheaded and, won't people listen to me? Don't they know who I am? Don't they know that I have experience with financial matters? And now I feel like, because I've been told that this is true, that I bring patience and calmness to discussions about money. And the district has plenty of money, so it's not like anybody should be concerned about it, but there's been some issues, and apparently I bring patience and a calm perspective. That's not me. That comes from going to more meetings, because when I go to more meetings, I hear the voice of God in what you guys have to say to me. I'd ask God to get me sober. Lots when I was drinking, and I always joked about being angry, and I joked about earlier being angry about him not getting me sober. I don't know. This is what I think. When I went through the steps, it was part of me making amends to the God, to my higher power, because it uncleared all the things that were blocking me from him. I don't know how other people want to think about it. In my mind, I think about it as me making amends to him, because I now have a relationship with a higher power. I can pray, and I know I'm praying to something that I understand and I get. I know that I get graces in my life that I don't deserve. He didn't get me sober because I didn't really ask him. My first sponsor made it pretty clear that I actually hadn't ever asked him. And I needed all of those steps to unblock the path so that I could actually hear his voice, so that I could walk in his sunlight, so that I could know where I was supposed to be. I did eventually wear down and start going to this meeting out of town, driving an hour each way. And that's been great. I now all of a sudden have friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I first started coming to the rooms, I can remember very early on thinking my life was over because I like to hang out in bars. That's where all my friends were. And so I can remember very early on being on the phone with my brother one night after a meeting. I'm in Kmart because I'm going to buy a video game system because I'm pretty sure my life is going to consist of going to work, going to meetings, and sitting at home and playing video games. Gosh, was I wrong. You know, it's funny. When I wasn't going to very many meetings, I didn't have anything to offer. I was spiritually sick. I didn't realize how spiritually sick I was. I didn't realize how little I had to offer. I started going to more meetings. I started doing the things that a lot of the guys around me do. All of a sudden, I've got a couple of sponsees that I have the honor to be able to work with a handful of guys. And that's really just, I don't know why anybody would ever want to work with me because I'm crazy. But, you know, apparently my experience is good for these guys. I think I got asked to speak twice in the first 4 years of coming to meetings. I've spoken three or four times this month. Not to say that I'm this great speaker, but I just get asked now. I didn't ever get asked to do anything. You know, a guy from our home group was getting married last year. A bunch of people went to play golf. I got asked to play golf with these guys. I know some, but not a lot. A couple of them went fishing a couple of weeks ago. I was invited to go along. I wasn't able to because I had another commitment. But I get invited to do things with people. People want to spend time with me. I hear from some people when I walk into a room that they're so happy to see me that they feel like that didn't happen when I was drinking. I didn't have a life when I was drinking. I lived in a hole of my own making. I was the guy who could be alone in a room full of people. That doesn't happen now. Occasionally I have to go out of town for work, and I don't always get to meetings when I'm out of town because my schedule can be so choppy. But the last time I was out of town, I really felt like I needed a meeting. So I made this great big effort to get to a meeting, $40 cab ride. It was just, and I got there and I thought I was 30 minutes late because there was rain and traffic and whatever. They had two meetings. I was 40 minutes late for the beginner's meeting, but I was there right on time for the other meeting and ran into people, and all of a sudden, 3 minutes after walking into this room, not even, 30 seconds after walking into a room where a meeting was going to be held, and I had five new friends. And I use that term friends a little loosely, but I had five people who I understood and who understood me. You know, I walked up tonight, every single person here greeted me. I'm assuming because I was wearing a tie. But no. Because I know that if I go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to run into people who think like me, who act like me, who talk like me, who know how to do the right thing. And see, I said I can never speak. I can never stop on time. We're 5 till 7, and I'll wrap up here in just a second. You know, I never would have imagined my life this way. I think when I was growing up, I wanted to be famous. My life goal was to be famous. I wanted to be in the Encyclopedia Britannica. I don't even know if that's a thing anymore. And I'm not. I'm clearly not famous. But my life is full. Full of people. Full of wonderful commitments. I get to be there for my kids. Even when I'm not there for my kids because I'm at a meeting or because I'm at work, I still get to be there for my kids because I can work today. I get to be there for my boss. Our business is growing. Our relationship is good. I get to be there for the guys that I sponsor, even when I'm not perfect at that. You know, when life happens, I don't react to it. I just keep doing what I've been taught to do. And things seem to work themselves out. I couldn't have imagined this life, but anything I imagined would have been not as good as what I have. And I don't know how else to really say it. You know, if I'd gotten everything I ever wanted, I wouldn't have gotten half of what I have now. And I would probably be a miserable, lonely SOB and would take door number, you know, take that alcoholic death that my dad took, because I wouldn't have had any way to deal with what was coming at me in life. And, because Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't have to live like that. I get to live, yeah, as the book says, happy, joyous, and free. So thanks a lot for letting me share tonight, and thanks.